dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to the program. I'm Bill Gertz, filling in for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. I'm the defense and national security columnist for the Washington Times and the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon. We're broadcasting today from the Free Beacon's offices at 16th and K in downtown Washington. Joining me on the program now is Andy McCarthy, a former federal prosecutor and contributing editor with National Review Online. We're going to be talking about the constitutionality of Obamacare. Welcome to the program, Andy.
Bill, good to be with you.
You've certainly ignited a good legal argument here on the Obamacare's unconstitutional origins. Can you fill us in on this important piece?
Well, Bill, I think there's two different things to look at. One is an opinion that I turned out to hold surprisingly, from my perspective, controversially, because I didn't really think there was all that much controversy about this, which is that the Constitution requires that bills for raising revenue, at least as it's put in the Constitution, be originated in the House of Representatives. And I thought that this bore on the debate that we're currently having over the shutdown and the continuing resolution, because what happened in that instance was the House stripped out any spending for Obamacare, and the Senate added it back in. And even though it's not a bill for raising revenue specifically in this instance, I think if you go back into the constitutional debates, the debates around the Constitutional Convention, it's clear that the intention that the framers had in that provision, which is known as the Origination Clause, was to give the House of Representatives the power of the purse to control not only the raising of revenue, but actually spending. So I think the continuing resolution is a violation of the framework that the framers gave us, in which the House of Representatives is supposed to have the last word on controlling spending as well as raising revenue. But more narrowly, and I think everybody ought to be agreed on this, even if you think that the Constitution only vests the House with the authority to raise revenue, then Obamacare itself, that is the 2009-2010 legislation, the Affordable Care Act, or so-called Affordable Care Act, that clearly originated in the Senate. Basically, what happened was the House passed a totally unrelated bill, an uncontroversial, nondescript one that had to do with veterans housing, passed it by a margin of about 416-0. And then what the Senate did was take its monstrous 3,000-page Obamacare legislation and amend it into the House Act. So it clearly completely originated in the Senate. And it has, you know, even by its own accounting, it has any number of revenue-raising measures in it.
You also mentioned that Chief Justice Roberts really didn't solve the problem, as the administration likes to claim in his ruling last summer. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. The interesting thing with the way Obamacare was presented to the country was President Obama was absolutely adamant that it was not a tax. In fact, you know, he famously upbraided George Stephanopoulos on Stephanopoulos's TV show for, Stephanopoulos raising the specter of Obamacare being a tax. And Obama said it absolutely was not a tax. That's what the Obamacare proponents told the American people, because, you know, they wanted to at least appear to be keeping good on their promise not to raise taxes. And when the Supreme Court affirmed Obamacare, you know, the interesting thing is the administration keeps saying the administration, the Supreme Court upheld this law. Well, it's really not that simple. The Supreme Court actually found the law to be unconstitutional on the ground that Obama argued that it was supported by the Constitution, namely as an exercise of Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. Chief Justice Roberts said that the part of the act that was being upheld could only be upheld as a tax. But because the Obama administration presented it to the public not only as not a tax, but as basically the opposite of a tax, they insisted it wasn't a tax, we've never had the chance to make all of the constitutional arguments that you would make about whether something is valid as a tax. And I think that Obamacare clearly is not.
So in a sense, the Chief Justice said this is a tax, and therefore that bolsters the argument that you made in this recent National Review case that if it's a tax, then it had to have had originated in the House. What are the chances that this could actually be taken up by a court challenge by some of the Republicans? I think you mentioned Trent Franks is pushing this to try and get a court to take a look at the legality of this Obamacare Act.
Well, I think there's a very good chance of it. The there actually is, as you mentioned, a litigation already. The Representative Franks, along with I think a couple of dozen conservative members of the House of Representatives, are already pushing to file an amicus brief in a challenge that's based on the origination clause in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. There's another case, I think, that's coming out of Texas on the same issue. So this is already cruising through the court and probably, I think, headed back to the Supreme Court.
And so we could see down the road another major court challenge to Obamacare. In the meantime, obviously, Republicans and Democrats and even Republicans and Republicans are debating this issue. The latest is that John Boehner has came out and called for talks with the president and with Democrats to try and resolve the impasse. Doesn't look like there's much change going on in the government shutdown at this point. Where do you think this will finally end up? I mean, do you think that it will get an honest look at the courts, that someone could actually, and could it actually be overturned on the grounds that it didn't originate in the House?
I think, Bill, that it would be, I thought it was foolish the first time around for Republicans to rely on the Supreme Court to reverse this thing. And I'm not much more optimistic about it, you know, the next time around. Although I do think that, you know, if this were to come up, say, a year or two down the road, when people are dealing with the sticker shock of what this costs and all of the dysfunctional problems that we're seeing with it, you know, there may be more of a judicial temperament to reverse this thing if it actually looks like it violates the Constitution. I think the last time around, it very clearly. Violated the Constitution, but the court went out of its way to uphold it. That being the case, and that being the lesson I think we ought to take, you know, Republicans ought to be pushing very hard for a legislative repeal on this thing, and they ought to be trying to strip away from it every chance they get.
We're talking with Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor. Andy, in the minute and a half we have left, let's talk about the latest Obama administration terrorist capture. Abu Anas al-Libi captured in a covert commando raid in the capital of Tripoli. He's on a ship now in the Mediterranean, and it looks like the Obama administration, rather than send him to Guantanamo, is going to be readying him for prosecution in New York. I think you probably have some views on this. What's your take on the al-Libi prosecution prospects?
Well, I think it's refreshing, Bill, to see that they've at least realized that when you kill everybody that you would have otherwise had a chance to capture, you've dried up our intelligence base, and they understand that's something that has to be dealt with. But obviously, you know, this is so hyper-political. I mean, they're questioning him on a naval ship, and they're doing that because they won't bring him to Guantanamo for political reasons. We ought to be questioning this guy for as long as he's useful to us for intelligence purposes. Miranda should not be part of this, and they don't need post-arrest statements to convict this guy. What they need is his intelligence to help protect the country.
And we'll have to leave it at there. Again, we've been talking with Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor. Andy, thanks for being on the show.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back on Secure Freedom Radio. This is Bill Gertz of the Washington Free Beacon and the Washington Times filling in for Frank Gaffney, who's in Israel and will be back next week. Before we bring in our next guest, I wanted to talk about an important story today in the Free Beacon. The headline is Terror Raids Ignore Benghazi Suspects. The U.S. Special Operations Forces conducted a daring commando raid in Tripoli to capture a senior al-Qaeda leader, but missed going after two or three main suspects in the Benghazi attack last year in September. That attack killed the U.S. ambassador and three other Americans, and yet some people are worried now that they've taken this daring action that this is going to drive these Benghazi suspects, many of whom are whose locations have been known publicly. Again, this is an important story. We urge you to go look at it on the Washington Free Beacon at freebeacon.com. Joining me now on the program is Mark Thompson, a veteran defense writer for Time magazine and a Pulitzer Prize-winning defense reporter. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill.
Daring raid took place this past weekend. What's the larger political message in this? Here we are in the middle of a government shutdown, the sequestration, all kinds of defense problems for the United States, and our special operations guys conducted some daring raids there. How do you see these raids as impacting the what used to be called the war on terrorism?
Well, what I think was interesting, Bill, is we've gone away from decade-long wars with an alliance to unilateral strikes that are trying to capture bad guys as opposed to kill them, at least over the past weekend. And obviously what's significant about that is the intelligence windfall that might come from that. They're batting 500, which is pretty good in baseball. They got the guy in Libya. They didn't get the guy in Somalia. And it just shows, I think, the reach, the global reach of U.S. military power.
We're talking with Mark Thompson. Again, U.S. Special Operations Forces conducted a daring raid in Tripoli, captured Abu Anas al-Libi. He's been linked to the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. He could produce an intelligence windfall again. However, he's not going to Guantanamo. He's on a ship in the Mediterranean, and the next stop for him looks like a prosecution in New York City. Who is al-Libi, and what could he possibly tell us about al-Qaeda?
Well, he's a longtime al-Qaeda operative. I mean, it does date back to the mid-90s. He worked closely with Osama bin Laden, although in recent years he seems to have taken himself out of play. He moved back to Libya to help overthrow Gaddafi and rejoined his family not that long ago. I mean, it's rather interesting when you think that in this changing war on terror, the Navy is using its pretty new USS San Antonio as basically a $1.7 billion floating one-man brig.
Yeah, they've got him captured there. And, you know, they've got an indictment that they're going to be dusting off from 2000. That looks like it's going to have most of the information. The Pentagon, in their statement, George Little said that they were going to try and get intelligence information from him. But as you mentioned, he seems to have been relatively inactive. Let's look at the al-Shabaab raid. This was going after an al-Shabaab leader named Ikruma. They met with resistance. Apparently, it was in a seaside town about 120 miles south of Mogadishu. What do you think happened there? Did they lose the element of surprise?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've heard, that they lost the element of surprise. They came in these small inflatable boats, and they were, you know, the bad guys were there waiting for them. There was a 15 to 20 minute firefight. The SEALs could have pressed their way in with additional air support, which they elected not to use, and because they elected not to use it because of concern over civilian casualties, I'm told, they had no option but to withdraw. It was sort of a perfect setup for the SEALs, given that the target was just offshore. I mean, you don't need really to use helicopters. You don't need to use vehicles. You can come in on pretty quiet boats from the mothership. But for some reason, and we don't know yet, there was apparently the element of surprise was lost.
We're talking with Mark Thompson on Secure Freedom Radio. Let's shift our focus to Asia. The president this week canceled a significant trip to two summits in Asia at a key time when the Obama administration is engaged in what is being called the pivot to Asia. A lot of people who are looking at this say that this is a setback for the pivot policy. Secretary of State Kerry is going in the president's place, but clearly there's a lot going on in that area. Southeast Asia in particular, we see a lot of maritime disputes between China and its neighbors there. Do you think that the president canceling his trip to Indonesia, Philippines, Brunei, and Malaysia will hurt this this pivot policy?
Well, let's face it, Bill, nature abhors a vacuum. And when the president felt he had to cancel his trip, that obviously meant that the Chinese presence would loom even larger, because no Secretary of State can match up to the president. And the fact of the matter is, a pivot, you know, we think of a pivot as only going 180 degrees, but sometimes that pivot can go all 360 degrees. And given the weekend troubles in Africa, the troubles in Syria, the troubles in Afghanistan, it almost looks like we're back where we started right now.
And the troubles in Washington, D.C. on top of that.
That's the pivot point.
Yes. And it also looks like the pivot could be a head fake. There's been, you know, it's been a very relatively low-key effort, although just recently last week they had a major meeting in Japan, the 2+2 talks, where the alliance was upgraded. They're in the process of reviewing that. They're sending tilt-rotor aircraft to Japan. They're going to send Global Hawks, going to be moving troops. So at least in Northeast Asia, things seem to be different. The Philippines seems to be one of those states in Asia that is very concerned about Chinese encroachment, specifically the Spratly Islands, and there's even talk of a new U.S. military presence in Philippines. Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, I mean, I think what's important for folks to realize is, number one, ever since 9/11, our military really stepped up the pace, and it got bigger, and it got a lot more expensive. That is by and large gone now, and given the end of the Cold War, and given the drawdown that is permitted to occur in Europe, a lot of excess forces we now have. Now, the U.S. military is shrinking, but you still have to have a focus of activity. And I think, based on folks I speak to in and out of government, the Pacific is the scene of action. And despite our big trade relationship with China, it's obvious that Beijing makes its neighbors very nervous. So a lot of those countries are looking to cozy up a little more to the United States.
In the final 30 seconds we have left, Mark, we're talking with Mark Thompson, a defense writer at Time Magazine. The Pentagon is recalling civilians who have been furloughed due to the shutdown. I guess the criteria there is that if they are involved in the morale and well-being and capabilities and readiness of the service members, they'll come back. How do you see that, the recall of these DOD workers?
Well, I mean, we saw the same issue with the furloughs, when initially they were going to have to be furloughed for many days, and it ended up being 5 or 6 days. In the same way, there's a growing number of essential Pentagon employees who are being called back to work despite the shutdown, and all I can say is it's good they don't lump journalists into essential and non-essential categories.
We've been talking with Mark Thompson of Time Magazine. Mark, thanks for being on the program. I'm Bill Gertz. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth. and the 10th. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Under President Obama, the United States has switched sides in the war on terror. For example, we're now sending funds and arms to jihadists in Syria trying to overthrow the Assad regime there. But they're also committed to imposing their supremacist Sharia doctrine worldwide, including here. One reason why we now support such enemies is that individuals associated with the Muslim Brotherhood have gotten inside the wire of the Obama administration. Prominent among them is Mohammed El Ibiari, a Texas-based Islamist who serves on the Department of Homeland Security's Advisory Council. El Ibiari's Islamist sympathies were exposed in an interview published yesterday at securefreedom.org. No good can come from our government being associated with, let alone taking advice from, a man so closely aligned with America's enemies like the Muslim Brotherhood. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back. This is Bill Gertz filling in for Frank Affney on Secure Freedom Radio. Our next guest on the program is Scott Truver. Scott is the director of Team Blue National Security Programs at Griffon Technologies, specializes in national and homeland security, naval and maritime strategies, policies, and programs. He's had a distinguished career. He's assisted in numerous Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard strategy papers and policy documents reports, beginning with From the Sea back in 1992. Joining us now, Scott. Welcome to the program.
Bill, thanks very much for the opportunity to be here today.
Today we're going to be talking about aircraft carriers. You've talked about this. What can you tell us about this recent article that you've written on aircraft carriers and the need for aircraft carriers in U.S. strategy?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to do is raise the issue again about what tactical air power from the sea means, and particularly in today's environment. And looking backward, maybe we'll glean some lessons learned from the 1970s, 1980s, about what went into some of the decisions to procure aircraft carriers, the Nimitz-class carriers, for example. We almost have the situation where we're going to have a new class, the Ford class, join the service in 2015. And I wanted to put that within context of decisions about aircraft carriers generally.
Yeah, it's certainly an important power projection capability. I can remember back in the late 90s, I had the experience of covering the USS George Washington in the Persian Gulf. It was truly amazing to see carrier operations, planes taking off and landing in darkness. It's also a capability that a lot of other nations are seeking. And first of all, China comes to mind. The Chinese have refurbished an old Soviet carrier. The Varyag is now the Liaoning. And it looks like the Chinese are getting ready to gear up for carrier operations. The word is that they have at least one and perhaps as many as four more of indigenous carriers. How's that going to factor into U.S. strategy down the road? We have, what do we have, 10 or 11 carriers?
Well, we have 10 carriers right now, but only temporary because CVN 65 Enterprise was deactivated last December. So we got special permission from the Congress to go from 11 carriers down to 10 for a short period of time, still 2015 when the Gerald Ford enters the fleet. An interesting problem is, with regard to China is that they're trying to do in a short period of a couple of years, maybe a decade, what the U.S. Navy has done over 75 years in tactical air power at sea. And good luck to them for doing some of the things that you described on George Washington, the ballet of ship handlers, carrier people on the deck, and the aircraft themselves in near total darkness, landing and taking off with nary an incident. It's going to be interesting to watch the Chinese try to replicate in a short period of time what took us a long period of time. But be that as it may, they look to be sea control and area denial type of assets to help help engage their interests beyond the second island chain in maritime disputes and fisheries, atolls, that sort of thing. So it looks like they're going to, over the next 10 or 15 years, to have a reasonably effective aircraft carrier force, but I don't think it'll be anywhere close to the capabilities that the U.S. Navy has today and will continue to evolve over the future.
We're talking with Scott Truver about why America needs aircraft carriers. One of the arguments that's been made against carriers is their vulnerability. And this is becoming a key factor as the Chinese are in the early stages of deployment of a DF-21D, which is a unique anti-ship ballistic missile. I've heard testimony from admirals on Capitol Hill that they're saying that, well, yes, we can defend against this, and the way they do that is to get into the kill chain of that weapon system, that is, otherwise disrupt its communications, navigation, guidance, and targeting. You make an argument that we still need carriers, even if there is this vulnerability. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the vulnerability has been something that, with regard to carrier aviation, pretty much acknowledged since Langley first went to sea when in 1920s. Yes, aircraft can attack ships, and if they're lucky enough to get a couple of hits, the carrier can be damaged and sometimes sunk. We found that out during World War II. The issue of that's challenging today is that our potential adversaries have wonder weapons. Well, Billy Mitchell dropping bombs on ships during the 20s and 30s could be perceived as a similar wonder weapon against the ships. it doesn't take into account the entire capability of a carrier and the carrier strike group to steam within 24 hours. They can present an area of uncertainty of 16,800 square miles. It's a where's Waldo problem that, frankly, the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance capabilities of the Chinese government aren't really up to the task. Perhaps in the next 20 years, but there are other ways in which the vulnerability to weapon systems can be abated. And the ships themselves, they are the most rugged ships that we have in the naval forces. They have extensive passive protection features if something were to get through. The ships themselves can fight last-ditch efforts with weapon systems, as well as the passive capabilities of the inherent in the construction of the ships themselves. And the DF-21, it's not new. It's new for people who haven't studied history. The Soviet Navy, and we remember the good old days of the Soviet Navy, had an SSNX-13 missile, which was widely thought to be an anti-submarine missile, but in reality, it was an anti-carrier weapon that the Soviets tested. Actually, had an IOC in the 1970s, but after that, never went back to sea with weapon again. So, vulnerability is on a sliding scale. If you can make your ship itself rugged enough to take hits and keep on fighting, which they did during World War II, and in instances during the Cold War, so much the better. And indeed, they are complemented by Aegis cruisers and destroyers, the Arleigh Burke class and Ticonderoga class, which have excellent anti-aircraft warfare capabilities, as well as extremely and growing capabilities against ballistic missiles. So I think that the people who have been crying wolf about the carrier being vulnerable just don't have it within the proper context. All ships are vulnerable. Carriers are a whole lot less vulnerable than the joint high-speed vessel or the total combat ship, for example.
And, of course, land-based bases are also even more vulnerable because they can't be moved like a carrier. We're talking with Scott Truver. Scott, in addition to the Chinese, it looks like the Japanese are also getting into the carrier business. They recently launched a helicopter carrier. The Indians seem to be moving in that way, too. And then there's reports out of Iran that Iran is seeking an aircraft carrier capability. Is this going to in any way challenge U.S. naval supremacy in the field of aircraft carriers?
Well, in any cases, they're our friends, at least for now. So we would look at the ways in which we could complement each other's capabilities of tactical aviation at sea. Most of these smaller navies, aircraft carriers or aircraft carriers in anything but name, air-capable ships or very similar to our LHD and LHA amphibious warfare ships, without the marine contingents, of course. So I think we're looking at these as frankly an underscoring of the value of tactical naval aviation at sea, the ability to move virtually anywhere you want in international ocean space, to be able to sit off an adversary's coast at 12 miles off the coast just to remind them we're here. And indeed, when it's necessary to launch both offensive and defensive aircraft to carry the day. So I would look at this as a confirmation of the requirements for aircraft carriers, not any kind of a threat to the U.S. Navy's aircraft carrier programs per se.
Yeah, it's clear that aircraft carriers are the key element in U.S. Power projection. Scott Truver, Director of Team Blue National Security Programs at Gryphon Technologies, thank you for being on the program.
My pleasure, Bill.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill.
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Bill Gertz filling in for Frank Gaffney, who's in Israel and will be back next week. Our next guest is Colonel Robert S. Spalding III of the U.S. Air Force. He's a military fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and his most recent assignment was commander of the 509th Bomb Wing at Whiteman Air Force Base. That's where our B-2 bombers are based. Welcome to the program, Colonel.
Thank you so much, and hello to everyone out there. I just want to make one clarification. I was a vice commander, not the commander, and these are all going to be my personal opinions, not representative of the Air Force necessarily.
Understood. You recently wrote a piece that talked about the importance of nuclear weapons, and we're facing a situation, Representative Mike Rogers, the chairman of the House Armed Services Strategic Forces Subcommittee, gave a speech recently where he said that our nuclear forces are in urgent need of modernization and that funding for that modernization is about $1 billion short. From your view, up close and personal with the nuclear deterrent forces, how do you see the status of our nuclear deterrent forces right now and what needs to be done to maintain them?
Well, I would say that they're strong, but the reason I wrote the particular piece is because I felt that, at least in the foreign policy circles, that maybe there was a little bit of misunderstanding of what the necessity of nuclear weapons were to our national defense, and it seemed like we needed some education in that area.
Yeah, you made the point in your article that nuclear weapons are actually weapons of peace, and that this is an element of peace through strength, which certainly we at the Center for Security Policy and Secure Freedom Radio, that's one of our key elements, that if you want to prevent conflict, you need to be strong. And certainly that we need a strong nuclear deterrent force for that. What about this Global Zero campaign that seems to have gained a lot of attention in recent months, the idea that we can just give up our nuclear weapons? Obviously, the Obama administration's position, the president himself said he'd like to get rid of all nuclear weapons, but also recognize that as long as there are nuclear weapons, we're going to need a good nuclear force. What's your take on the Global Zero movement?
Well, I think, one thing that happened after the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of, Strategic Air Command, I think we lost sight of the fact that nuclear weapons are still an important part of our national security. For instance, coming from the B-2, it goes anywhere from, going after terrorists like Osama bin Laden to limited strikes like in Libya to air wars like Kosovo, to full conflict like the Iraq invasion, and all the way to nuclear deterrence. And each of those situations requires somewhat different forces, maybe going after terrorists require special ops, limited strikes requires the Air Force or Navy, and, big combat requires the conventional forces. In addition, we require nuclear forces for deterrence, and we saw that especially with the rhetoric that was coming out of North Korea earlier. So it's an essential part of our national defense, just like the special forces guys will tell you. They're not the end-all, be-all, but they are important and useful when needed, and I think our nuclear forces play a different role than special ops or the conventional forces, but it's a vital role.
Absolutely. We need those nuclear forces to deter, to make it clear to any adversary that they would be making a huge strategic miscalculation. In light of that, these adversaries, one adversary or potential adversary that's building up their nuclear forces is the People's Republic of China. We've seen pretty large-scale buildup, largely in the background. There's very little transparency. I noticed that you have some expertise in this area. What do you think the purpose of the Chinese strategic nuclear buildup is?
Well, I think it's the same as any country that has nuclear weapons. It is to assure that their sovereignty is not challenged. One of the things that I see now, and I get a lot of questions about, is, what are the Chinese capabilities? What are our capabilities vis-a-vis the Chinese? And there seems to be this kind of, underlying belief that we are headed to for conflict with the Chinese. And I think that would, on many levels, be a mistake. Our nuclear force provides a great measure of deterrence for any type of conflict. And I made that point in the op-ed, one that, the nuclear forces provided that level of deterrence for the Soviets when the Cold War was raging. And as a result, we enjoyed peace when I think there was a lot of people that felt that, there was a possibility for a conflagration. It never occurred. And that's because nuclear weapons provide a threshold and a level of violence between two like armed enemies or combatants.
We're talking with Colonel Robert Spalding. Colonel, another area that's interesting is the Russian nuclear buildup. I'm sure that one of the recent strategy documents that was put out by the Pentagon made the point that we're no longer adversaries with Russia. But on the other hand, it does seem like the Russians are engaged in a fairly significant strategic nuclear buildup across the board. They're building new ICBMs. They're building new ballistic missile submarines, as are the Chinese. How do you see what's going on with the Russians there in terms of bolstering their nuclear forces?
I can't say exactly what their intent is, but the result is a credible force that needs to be reckoned with and needs to be dealt with seriously. You know, and the way we do that, the way we do it every single day, our air forces and Navy forces is to be constantly ready, and that will continue to be the case as is in the nuclear posture review, that those forces need to be ready up until the point where there is no nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, I don't see any mechanism by which that may take place in the future. In other words, I don't see a future where any nation out there is willing to unilaterally disarm. And so, you know, that means that they continue to be relevant. And if they're relevant, it requires that we continue to upgrade them, modernize them, and make sure that they have, you know, all the resources they need to continue to do the mission.
We're talking with Colonel Robert Spalding in the Council on Foreign Relations, military fellow. In your article in the Washington Post recently, you talked about the idea that the perceived march toward complete nuclear disarmament, using phrases for as long as nuclear weapons exist, weakens the very thing that ensures the peaceful future. And you talked about the fact that the idea that we only need these weapons until we can get rid of them is potentially harming the morale of the troops that are charged with defending the country in the use of these nuclear weapons. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I think, again, to go back to my earlier comments, I from my standpoint in the B-2 community, I see that there is a lot of attention paid to this special ops forces, conventional forces, while there has been recent attention to the nuclear forces based on the prior incidents we had in the forces, I think that there is a potential for that to lapse, and it's because I think that there's just an ongoing ignorance, I guess, about what the necessity is for nuclear weapons. Again, because I think people see the Cold War has ended, that they're no longer required, but they do have a relevance that continues and will continue for the foreseeable future. That's kind of the issue that I think that we're having now.
We've been talking with Colonel Robert Spalding, the former vice commander of the 509th Bomb Wing at Whiteman Air Force Base. Colonel, thanks very much for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
This is Bill Gertz filling in for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. We thank you for listening, and please tune in again next time.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.